Now, shall we begin?
I've just been advised that we have new videotape of the episode that apparently ended, we think ended, the move situation tonight, the dropping of an incendiary device. And let's take a careful look at this. 5:27 p.m., state police helicopter drops it. There is the explosion. As you can see, a very dramatic explosion that occurs 30 seconds and really rips into the move compound. There you see the bunker, which soon will go up in flames. And that was the explosion close up. Now, if there's anybody there, standing there, it's obvious they couldn't survive that explosion.
By the time Lieutenant Frank Powell hurled a satchel bomb onto the roof of the three-story row house on Philadelphia's Osage Avenue, the siege had gone on for nearly 12 hours. Powell was a member of the Philadelphia PD's bomb squad, and like the fireman in Ray Bradbury's dystopian novelette, he was performing a function assumed to be the opposite of his expected role. Rather than disposing of a military-grade bomb, he was using it as a weapon of mass destruction. The building targeted by Powell was occupied by members of a militant group called the MOVE. Aerial photographs taken shortly before the May 13, 1985 assault displayed a weapons bunker and large containers of oil on the roof of the row house. So it wasn't at all surprising that a few seconds after Powell heaved his bomb from the open door of a state police helicopter, a huge orange fireball erupted from the top of the building. The uncontained fire consumed that house and 60 others, leaving the entire neighborhood a smoldering ruin. Philadelphia was the only U.S. city to be bombed from the air during the Cold War, and the perpetrator of that attack was not the Soviet Union, the Weather Underground, or some other offshoot of the Soviet-inspired Tricontinental Movement. The perpetrators of this act of mass terrorism was the Philadelphia Police Department, with the indispensable help of the FBI and the U.S. military. Democratic Representative Bob Brady, who at the time of the siege was a deputy mayor of Philadelphia, recalls seeing all these military men giving advice during a planning session in Mayor Wilson Good's office. "I thought it would be a good idea if we got a boom crane to knock that bunker off," he recounted, "but somebody above my pay scale decided against it." That official was City Managing Director Leo Brooks, a retired brigadier general who approved of the plan and observed the bombing from the ninth floor balcony of a nearby geriatric center. Police Commissioner George Sambor, another retired military officer who, according to the son of longtime Philadelphia Mayor Frank Rizzo, ran around in fatigues, later testified that bombing the house was selected as a conservative and safe approach to what I perceived as a tactical necessity. "If the bomb hadn't been dropped from a helicopter," Sambor insisted, "the perception of that action would have been quite different. The only mistake the police made in firebombing that residence, apparently, was to get the optics wrong. This decision was not a matter of hasty, desperate improvisation, but rather of careful planning and premeditation." Prior to the May 13th assault, and without a formal request by the city's civilian government, Special Agent Michael Macy's of the Philadelphia FBI office provided the police bomb squad with 30 blocks of C4 explosive and several sticks of Tovex. Tovex, it should be pointed out, is the same high-yield explosive provided to Timothy McVeigh by an FBI asset in order to build the Oklahoma City bomb almost exactly 10 years later. Reasonable people would be justified in the suspicion that the use of the satchel bomb was the preferred option rather than a fallback plan. At the time of the detonation, Ramona Africa, a former paralegal who had become one of the most prominent and forceful representatives of MOVE, was hiding in the basement along with several children. They had sought refuge there after the police onslaught began, as Lieutenant Powell and his bomb squad comrades used small charges to blow holes in the wall in order to inject tear gas into the dwelling. "Attention, MOVE, this is America," declared Police Commissioner Sambor by way of a loudspeaker as the attack began. "You have to abide by the laws and rules of America." "We were in the cellar for a while, and the tear gas started coming in and we got blankets," recalled survivor Michael Moses Ward, who at the time of the events was known as Birdie Africa. "And we put them over our heads and started laying down. That strategy proved useless after the bomb went off, creating a fire that burned at an estimated 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit." Police and fire department officials later claimed that the original plan was to use tear gas and deluge guns, that is, high-volume fire hoses, to force the occupants out of the abandoned house pursuant to an eviction order and several arrest warrants on a variety of misdemeanor charges. Shortly after the first phase of the operation began, the sound of gunfire caused firefighters to scatter. Within the next 90 minutes, roughly 500 police officers would fire more than 10,000 rounds of ammunition into the dwelling. Another fusillade was unleashed after the bomb went off, and people attempted to flee from the burning building. "Come out, come out," whispered WCAU-TV photographer Peter Kane, horror-struck as he watched the fire from a nearby house he had staked out the previous evening. He wasn't aware that a tactical order had been issued to let the bunker burn. Nor was he aware that police officers, some of them wielding machine guns, others armed with silenced sniper rifles, had opened fire on MOVE members trying to escape the flames. Police officials claimed the use of overwhelming force was necessary because the MOVE possessed a vast arsenal that included automatic weapons. A search of the rubble turned up a total of 4 firearms, none of which was a machine gun. During a subsequent investigative hearing, Officer William Stewart reported that he heard automatic weapons fire as MOVE members tried to escape the Holocaust. When asked who was pulling the triggers, Stewart replied, "Police officers. All the stakeout officers were running into the alley. They all had Uzi machine guns." This account was corroborated by Officer James DeUlisi of the Philadelphia PD and John Vaccarelli and Joseph Murray of the City Fire Department. 11 people were killed as a result of the bombing. 6 of them, including 5 children, were cut down by gunfire as they fled the burning building. During a press conference held the evening of the fire, Mayor Good said he was fully accountable for what had happened that day, pointedly exonerating his subordinates. 10 months later, a special investigative commission described the bombing as unconscionable. Mayor Good was elected to a second term. None of the police officials involved in that atrocity was charged with a crime or subjected to administrative discipline. 4 years after the bombing, FBI Special Agent Macy's was suspended for 30 days, not for the unauthorized and illegal transfer of explosives, but for his evaluation of the FBI's liability in the matter, according to contemporaneous press accounts. The only person who endured punishment of any kind in this affair was Ramona Africa, who was convicted of riot and conspiracy. She spent 7 years in prison convalescing from the burns she endured while rescuing Birdie Africa, the only child to survive the firebombing. Following her release, Ramona received a $500,000 civil judgment from the city after every officer and policymaker involved in the bombing had been granted qualified immunity against personal liability. Rather than treating the incident as a tragic mistake or an act of criminal negligence, the FBI apparently used it to beta test tactics later employed against extremists of different varieties. During the 1992 siege at Ruby Ridge, Idaho, eyewitnesses and a TV camera crew saw an FBI helicopter take off carrying a large incendiary bomb that would have annihilated the Weaver family's pathetic dwelling and cremated the troublesome people residing therein. The April 19, 1993 assault by the FBI and Delta Force against the Branch Davidians involved tactics quite similar to those that had been employed against the MOVE and ended with paramilitary operators directing automatic weapons fire into the flames to deter or kill anyone seeking escape. As it happened, I was in Philadelphia on the morning of May 13, 1985, as part of a college performing group, specifically Showtime Company, which was a variety act sponsored by Ricks College. By the time we departed for our next engagement, the assault had already begun, and we heard news of a shootout shortly before our arrival in Washington, D.C. later that day. As we retired that evening, the local television news carried accounts of the firebombing, which commanded less attention in the news. Then another debacle that took place on the same day, the introduction of the new Coke in an event at Lafayette Park. The Coca-Cola Company's ill-advised decision to alter the formula of its toxic soft drink caused a paroxysm of national outrage on the part of a public that reacted to the Philadelphia firebombing with stolid indifference. Those who tampered with that product faced accountability. Jobs were lost, reputations were ruined, and corporate policies were changed. Nothing of the sort befell those responsible for a military assault on an urban neighborhood that left nearly a dozen people dead and hundreds of people homeless. Coca-Cola's decision to change its recipe was national news, as was the company's chastened decision to rescind that change. The firebombing of West Philly received perfunctory notice in the state-aligned media and was quickly forgotten by a materially sated population. As Commissioner Sambor said in his overture to the Holocaust on Osage Avenue, this is America. Or in any case, this is what we've allowed it to become. I'll be right back.
You hear the fire, Steve? I mean, they're really going at it now. It's automatic weapons. At this point, the people are starting to scatter at this side.
Some of these homes will start burning.
You're telling me that the homes on the other side of Osage Avenue may be on fire?
That's correct. There's white smoke coming from several roofs of the homes on the other side of Osage.
Any efforts to contain those small blazes before they get out of control?
No.
Friends, Pierce?
Hello.
Minorities? Jewesses? And the unseasonably tan?
That is inappropriate. And maybe you'll give that more weight since I'm white.
You've got a wide brow. What are you, Scandinavian?
Yeah, Swedish.
Swedish dogs? Your blood is tainted by generations of race mixing with Laplanders. You're basically Finns.
Oh my goodness, he's like the opposite of racism.
Hello, I'm Jared Taylor with American Renaissance. In Baltimore, we have just witnessed mob rule. It was dressed up as legal procedure, but it was mob rule. The mob rioted, and the mob got what it wanted. It all started on April 12th, when three white policemen arrested a black named Freddie Gray. It was his 19th arrest. Three more officers were then involved in taking him to the police station. Somewhere along the way, his spinal cord was injured. After he got to the station, he was rushed to the hospital, and he died a week later. The six officers were suspended while the Baltimore police investigated. But as we have learned, in Ferguson, Missouri, the Trayvon Martin case, Duke lacrosse team, Eric Garner in New York, blacks can't wait for an investigation. They want vengeance.
J.B. Stradford, the son of a freed Kentucky slave, rose to prominence in Oklahoma during the early 1900s, as one of the key developers of the all-black Tulsa enclave Greenwood. A lawyer and businessman, Stradford owned the 65-room hotel that sat right in the heart of the thriving community that would later become known as the Black Wall Street. But in a single day, all of that would change. On May 31st, 1921, the arrest of a young black man on a questionable charge of assaulting a young white woman touched off the deadliest race riot in U.S. history. Whites charged through the community in retaliation, leaving an estimated 300 people dead, another 10,000 black residents homeless, and 35 city blocks in ruin. Philadelphia, that is to say Western Philadelphia, more specifically Osage Avenue, was not the first or the only American neighborhood to be bombed from the air. That distinction actually belongs to Greenwood, that black enclave within Tulsa. Welcome back to Freedom is All the Radio. I'm William Grigg. In addition to producing this program, I am the author and the proprietor of the Pro Libertate blog, which can be found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I update that twice or three times a week, depending upon my schedule. There is a PayPal button at the bottom of every essay. There's one at the right-hand margin of the page. There's also a Bitcoin button. If you have the means to contribute, I would really appreciate your help. Stradford and 69 other black men were subsequently charged with inciting the riot in Greenwood, that section of Tulsa, to continue with this account by Monet Fields White, a journalist from Chicago. Stradford, however, jumped bail after his arrest and fled Tulsa for Kentucky. According to his great-granddaughter, Laurel Stradford, his son, her grandfather, who was also a lawyer, used legal maneuvering to help his father avoid having to stand trial, including filing a petition for a writ of habeas corpus to keep him from being unlawfully detained. But although J.B., who went on to run a successful law practice in Chicago, managed to avoid facing justice in Oklahoma. He never returned to that state. The charges hung over him until he died. The Stratford family fought to clear J.B., but it wasn't until 1996, 75 years after the riot and 6 decades after his death in 1935 in Chicago at the age of 75, that he was cleared of all charges. Ultimately, none of the men indicted were convicted of anything. The 75th anniversary year was also when the nation learned about the Tulsa race riot, which would come to be considered the most destructive race riot in history. For years, silence engulfed this incident, says Hannibal B. Johnson, author of Black Wall Street, From Riot to Renaissance in Tulsa's Historic Greenwood. In 1921, Tulsa was booming, so anything that would detract from its allure, such as the riot, was minimized. Indeed, Tulsa had been attracting thousands, blacks and whites, to the rich oil fields. By 1920, the overall population had swelled to more than 100,000 residents. Black Americans migrating from southern states as far as Georgia and Mississippi were also tempted to escape the harsh realities of southern racism. But old Jim Crow laws followed them northwest. Tulsa was divided into two cities. Whites held court in the southern end of the city, closer to the large main downtown area, while African Americans were segregated in the northern section of the town. The racial split, however, gave rise to Black Tulsa's famed entrepreneurial mecca. Anchored by Greenwood Avenue, Black-owned businesses stretched along more than a mile-long roadway. They included grocery stores, restaurants, medical and law offices, and 2 newspapers. Many Black entrepreneurs, in addition to Stratford, including real estate developer and Greenwood founder O.W. Gurley, thrived and reached regional and even national stature. Booker T. Washington, who had lectured in Tulsa, was the first to call Greenwood the Negro's Wall Street. That moniker later became the Black Wall Street. Many white Tulsans who referred to the district as Little Africa were not happy about the growth and prosperity of the community, according to Andrew Rosa, assistant professor of history at Oklahoma State University. You had a pretty stable, upwardly mobile people in Greenwood, and the city's whites had their eye on Greenwood, said Rosa. That was sort of the spirit of the friction. The underlying racial and economic tension finally boiled over on May 30th of 1921. Dick Rowland, a 19-year-old shoe shiner in downtown Tulsa, had gone to use the only bathroom for blacks, located at the top of an office building. He crossed paths with white elevator operator Sarah Page, 17, whom a store clerk claimed to have heard scream. The clerk said he found a distraught Page and saw a young black man running from the building. There is no record of what Page told the police. Rowland was arrested, but never charged. The incident, however, made the front page of the Tulsa Tribune, along with an editorial entitled, "To Lynch Negro Tonight." Right before dawn on June 1st, a mob of nearly 10,000 white men launched an all-out assault on the Greenwood District, systematically burning down every home and business. They dropped firebombs and shot at blacks from planes that had been used in World War I. That detail, by the way, has been disputed. However, in just a few minutes, I'm going to share with you the relevant section from a report compiled by an Oklahoma State Commission on this riot, which confirmed that there had been incendiary bombs dropped from airplanes, not necessarily operated by the military, but operated under the supposed authority of the Tulsa Police Department. Those blacks who were captured were held in internment camps around the city by the local police and National Guard units. Martial law was eventually declared. The National Guard confirmed that 37 blacks and whites were killed, although historians have put the number at closer to 300. Many of the dead black Americans were buried in unmarked graves around town, and some were laid to rest in an anonymous section of Tulsa's Oak Lawn Cemetery. Some photographers made their pictures of the dead into postcards. After the riot, black Tulsans who were living in tents and forced to wear green identification tags in order to work downtown still managed to turn the tragedy into triumph. Without state help, once again, without state help, they rebuilt Greenwood, and by 1942, the community had more than 240 black-owned businesses. In subsequent decades, however, the community declined as the pioneers of Greenwood died and many of their descendants moved away. The district struggled most critically during the 1960s as Tulsa became more integrated, which led to a decline in the Greenwood population and also undermined many of the local black family-run businesses. In the 1970s, a large segment of Greenwood was demolished to make way for an interstate highway that became a main connector for the downtown area. An Oklahoma State Commission conducted an investigation of the riot from 1997 to 2001, questioning survivors about that day back in 1921. The commission recommended specific reparations to the community, the living survivors, and the descendants. The state did subsequently enact a law in June 2001 that provided about 300 scholarships for descendants, developed a memorial, and pushed for development in Greenwood, but the law fell far short of what the commission had recommended. As someone who does not subscribe to the principle called corruption of blood, I do not support the practice of reparations, which in this case would mean compelled transfer payments from people who had nothing to do with an historic atrocity for the benefit of those who survived that atrocity or their descendants. I do think it is worthwhile to make formal notice of the institutional complicity of government entities in that pogrom. I'll be back in just a minute.
In the early 1900s, Tulsa's Greenwood District was known as the most affluent and thriving black community in the nation. The segregated area sustained itself with banks and commerce. Greenwood was a place where any man or woman of color could become prosperous. The residents were highly educated, drove fancy cars, and dressed to the nines.
Well, if you can imagine walking down the 100 block of Greenwood and seeing all manner of shops, dress shops, haberdasheries, beauty shops, professional offices, lots of lawyers, doctors, and so forth, all in one narrow, discreet area.
Noted African-American historian Hannibal Johnson says Greenwood was thriving at a time when race relations were at their worst in the country. In 1919, there were over 25 major race riots in America. In 1921, it was Tulsa's turn. Between May 31st and June 1st of that year, Greenwood, known at the time as the Negro Wall Street, burned to the ground.
In 1921, Tulsa was booming thanks to the discovery of oil, and many African Americans had also prospered. Most black people lived in the racially segregated Greenwood section of the city, which contained stores, shops, hotels, banks, newspapers, schools, theaters, and restaurants. Greenwood had several wealthy black entrepreneurs and was sometimes called the Black Wall Street of America. By 1921, membership in the Ku Klux Klan was rapidly spreading throughout America, and an active chapter had been formed in Tulsa. The riot was triggered over a Memorial Day weekend by a report in two white newspapers that a black youth had tried to rape, or at least assault, a young white woman elevator operator. One of the newspapers allegedly editorialized that the youth ought to be hanged. Rumors raced through the black community that a lynch mob was planning to hang the youth. A group of armed African-American men, who were, incidentally, veterans of World War I, rushed to the police station with the intention of preventing a lynching from occurring. I think it's important to point out that they were actually there as an informal, spontaneously organized posse to support the sheriff, who, to his credit, was trying to prevent a lynching. There was no lynch mob, but a confrontation developed between blacks and whites. Shots were fired, and some whites were killed. As the news spread throughout the city, mob violence exploded. Thousands of whites rampaged through the black community, killing men and women, burning and looting stores and homes. Some blacks claimed that policemen had joined the mob. Others claimed that a machine gun was fired into the black community, and a plane dropped sticks of dynamite. When the National Guard arrived, it arrested blacks rather than white rioters. Some 4,000 to 5,000 men and women were held in custody for several days before being released. No whites were arrested, even though many of the mob members openly boasted of what they had done. 35 blocks of Greenwood were burned to the ground, wiping out businesses and homes. Reports of the number of blacks killed ranged from 25 to 300. Approximately 20 whites were also killed. In the official commission report by the Oklahoma state government into the riot of 1921, there is a chapter entitled Airplanes and the Riot, compiled by historian Richard S. Warner. Mary E. Jones Parrish included a number of references to airplanes in her book Events of the Tulsa Disaster. In her own account of her experiences during the riot, she mentions seeing fast-approaching airplanes. Moreover, in her escape from the riot area, Paris tells of nearing the aviation fields, in all likelihood, the Curtis Southwest airfield, and seeing the planes out of their sheds all in readiness for flying, and these men with high-powered rifles getting into them. Parrish adds that the airplanes continue to watch over the fleeing people like great birds of prey watching for a victim, but I have not heard of them doing any harm to the people out in the direction where we were. Events of the Tulsa disaster also includes interviews, including one with Mr. James T. West, a teacher at Booker T. Washington High School, who reported that airplanes flew over very low, and what they were doing I cannot say, for I was in my room. Dr. R. T. Bridgewater, an assistant county physician, stated that he was near my residence and airplanes began to fly over us, in some instances very low to the ground, and that he heard a woman say, "Look out for the airplanes, they are shooting upon us." Mrs. Parrish also wrote that more than a dozen airplanes went up and began to drop turpentine balls upon the Negro residences, but she gives no source for this statement, nor does it appear that she witnessed this herself. Mrs. Parrish also included the testimonial of an anonymous eyewitness who stated, "Then I saw airplanes. They flew very low. To my surprise, as they passed over the business district, they left the entire block a mass of flame." Other contemporary sources also reported the presence of airplanes. Walter White wrote in the June 29, 1921 issue of The Nation that 8 airplanes were employed to spy on the movements of the Negroes and, according to some, were used in bombing the colored section. Mabel E. Little, in her unpublished biography, wrote that airplanes dropped incendiary bombs to enhance the burning of Mount Zion Baptist Church and business buildings. A reporter for the Oklahoma City Black Dispatch wrote that airplanes were seemingly everywhere. They seemed to fly low, and I could see the men of the planes as they passed us. In an interview with Dr. Payne and Mrs. Robinson that appeared in the same issue, it was stated that these two men with their wives succeeded in reaching the open country. They were finally spotted by the air murderers who showered load after load of leaden missiles upon them. W.I. Brown, a porter on the Katy Railroad who reached Tulsa Wednesday morning, June 1st, with the National Guard, recited this story. "We reached Tulsa about 2 o'clock. Airplanes were circling all over Greenwood. We stopped our cars north of the Katy Depot, going towards Sand Springs. The heavens were lighted up as plain as day from the many fires over the Negro section. I could see from my car window that 2 airplanes were doing most of the work. They would every few seconds drop something, and every time they did, there was a loud explosion and the sky would be filled with flying debris." Bruce Harnett of Tulsa Junior College interviewed Mabel Bonner Little in 1969 and 1971. He asked Mrs. Little, "Do you remember during the time of the riot itself if there were any airplanes, people dropping stuff?" Mrs. Little replied, "Oh yes, they dropped those incendiary bombs. That's what burned those big buildings down. They couldn't have destroyed them with anything else." In case number 23,331 filed in the District Court of Tulsa County between Barney Cleaver, plaintiff, and the City of Tulsa, one of the defendants was the St. Clair Oil Company. The fourth paragraph of the plaintiff's petition alleges that the St. Clair Oil Company, a corporation, did, at the request and insistence of the city's agents, and in furtherance of the conspiracy aforementioned and set out, furnish airplanes on the night of May 31st, 1921, and on the morning of June 1st, 1921, that the said J.R. Blaine, captain of the police department, with others, was carried in said airplane, which dropped turpentine balls and bombs down upon the houses of the plaintiff. The 1921 Tulsa City Directory does not list a J.R. Blaine, but it does list a G.H. Blaine, a police captain. Captain Blaine appears in a number of newspaper articles concerning airplanes, and there is no question that he was a pilot or passenger on a number of flights. The same source does not list a St. Clair Oil Company, but its phonetic similarity to the Sinclair Oil Company is too close to be ignored. The Chicago Defender, on June 11, 1921, reported that at 4:30 a steam whistle sounded 3 times. With the coming of daylight, airplanes from the local aviation field, in which the Cadillac Company is interested, directed the movement of the oncoming army. At 6:15 a.m., men in the planes dropped firebombs of turpentine or other inflammable material on the property. The article goes on to say, one man leaning far out from an airplane was brought down by the bullet of a sharpshooter, and his body burst upon the ground. Other newspapers published similar claims. The St. Louis Argus, on June 10, 1921, reported that the Negroes held their own until about 6 o'clock in the morning, when a fierce attack was made upon them from the hill by cannons, and airplanes soared over the Negro section, dropping fire on their houses. J.W. Hughes, principal of Dunbar Grade School, wrote a statement that said that at 5 o'clock a whistle was blown, 7 airplanes were flying over the colored district. As some newspaper accounts mentioned nitroglycerin bombs, it is interesting to note that the Tulsa World published an article on April 20, 1921, titled "Tulsa Man First to Transport Nitro by Means of an Airplane." The article discusses the great danger in transporting nitroglycerin and notes that a careless movement may only leave a grease spot. There is quite a bit of information that the police used airplanes to search the outskirts of the black area for fleeing people. When individuals were seen, a message was placed in a container and dropped to search parties on the ground. These containers may have been thought to be bombs by some. In reply to a request for information from people concerning the riot, one man called in and said that his uncle, Charles Ford, a Tulsa policeman, flew one of these search planes. He said that 3 planes were used and they flew in a V formation with his uncle in the lead. The planes, he believed, were used for reconnaissance only. Another oral informant, Lillian Luff, reported that her grandmother, a recent immigrant from Mexico, lived on the edge of the black area in 1921. At the time of the riot, she saw 2 young black boys running down the street being followed by a 2-seater airplane. The man in the rear seat was shooting at the boys. She then ran out and grabbed the boys and took them into the house. The man in the airplane stopped shooting when she appeared. Professor Warner concludes that it's pretty clear that aircraft were used by the police for surveillance activities, and that there is a preponderance of evidence that at least some of these aerial missions were bombing raids or strafing runs conducted against the people who were fleeing from the race riot that had descended upon their neighborhood. I'll be back in just a minute. Indiscriminate annihilation of identified enemies by fire, including women and children, appears to be a leitmotif in the conduct of the regime that rules us. We might begin with Andrew Jackson's behavior during the Red Sticks War. On one occasion, he ordered his troops to surround a lodge that was filled with men, women, and children, all of whom were noncombatants, and to set that building on fire. I've already mentioned what happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921. This tactic became industrialized during World War II in the firebombing of Tokyo and Hamburg and Dresden. It was imported for domestic use by the Philadelphia Police Department in May of 1985. A few years later, the Waco siege led to a Holocaust that killed scores of people. That fire was almost certainly triggered by the use of an incendiary round following several hours of gassing involving a chemical agent that is banned for battlefield use by international convention. Between 1985 and 1993, we saw an abortive attempt by the FBI to firebomb the Weaver home at Ruby Ridge, Idaho. From the October 9, 1985 New York Times, we read the following. A panel appointed to conduct an inquiry into the police bombing of the radical group MOVE opened hearings today that its chairman said would determine the facts without regard to personal interests. 11 people were killed in the group's house and a neighborhood was destroyed in the resulting fire. The chairman of the panel, William H. Brown III, said in his opening remarks, "We are charged with the responsibility of gathering all the facts, searching them out wherever they may be, without regard to the personal interests of those upon whom the responsibility may be placed." A gun battle erupted after the police tried to evict MOVE, which had been harassing residents of the middle-class West Philadelphia neighborhood in an attempt to free jailed members. By drawing attention to their cause by using loudspeakers to harangue the neighborhood residents, the group's members had apparently hoped to put pressure on city officials. We fast forward now to May 4th of 1993, which is about 8 years after the firebombing of the MOVE, In the Philadelphia Inquirer, we read the following report. An independent three-member team was named yesterday by the Department of the Treasury to review the agency's investigation of the events that triggered the 51-day standoff in Waco, Texas. Named yesterday to the review panel were Los Angeles Police Chief Willie L. Williams, who was Philadelphia's police commissioner until last year, former Philadelphia Inquirer editorial page editor Edward O. Guthman, who teaches journalism at the University of Southern California, and former Watergate prosecutor Harry S. Ruth Jr., who served on a Philadelphia Citizens Board that reviewed the 1985 MOVE incident. A Treasury spokesman said it was coincidental that all three panel members have strong ties to Philadelphia. The panel is scheduled to have its initial meeting with Treasury officials in Los Angeles in about a week. The investigative report and review are to be completed within 120 days, a Treasury statement said. The group is charged with examining Treasury's probe of the events that led to the bloody shootout on February 28th, when agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms attempted to serve search and arrest warrants at the Branch Davidian compound outside Waco. Four ATF agents were killed and 16 wounded during the ensuing shootout, raising questions about the tactics employed by the ATF, a bureau of the Treasury Department. If the objective were to arrest somebody suspected of a crime, this could have been accomplished without laying siege to a dwelling. Ramona Africa, who was the only person arrested and charged and jailed as a result of what happened on May 13th, 1985, pointed out that the people who were living within the MOVE commune could have been arrested while they were going to the grocery store or visiting friends or playing basketball. This is something that could have been done through the exercise of minimal force and in a way that was highly discriminatory in the best sense of that expression, meaning that the effort would focus upon particular people suspected of specific crimes. But that wasn't the purpose of the police conduct toward the MOVE. They wanted to send a message. They wanted to make a point regarding the sovereignty of the political entity that they served. The same thing was true with respect to David Koresh. In the case of David Koresh, you have a thoroughly discredited entity, the ATF, which was enduring a wave of negative publicity owing to disclosures about misconduct, including sexual misconduct of many high-ranking people within that agency. And that's an agency that exists without constitutional warrant. The federal government's got no business being involved in the regulation of alcohol, tobacco, or firearms. David Koresh was seen as a marquee caliber villain because he had been depicted by people who had left his movement as a violent cult leader with messianic delusions. A high-profile attack on this isolated community, which was codenamed Showtime, as something other than coincidence has it, would serve multiple purposes, not the least of which would be to provide a wave of adulatory headlines for the ATF. The purpose of an official commission of this kind is not to impose accountability, but rather to prevent it. Every commission ends up disgorging a huge and detailed report that is replete with platitudinous assurances that lessons have been learned and policies will change, but they never do. In the end, after all the weeks of chilling testimony and tales of official ineptitude, Henry W. Ruth Jr., the former Watergate special prosecutor, could no longer contain himself, reported the November 11, 1985 Philadelphia Inquirer. He was tired, angry, and disgusted. His voice quaked with indignation at the stone-faced city officials who had presided over one of the worst disasters in Philadelphia history. As I understand the testimony of the four people here, people under them made mistakes, but they didn't, Ruth said. Not one, he complained, had accepted blame for a bombing and fire that killed 11 people and destroyed 250 homes, or had admitted making a mistake in appearances before the MOVE Commission. Mayor W. Wilson Good, he noted, had claimed, "I did everything a mayor should." My problem is that, as a citizen, the idea of dropping a bomb in an urban area of row houses should have been rejected out of hand, Ruth said. Ruth's remarks came in the emotional final hour of 5 weeks of hearings about the May 13th incident. The hearings, broadcast for more than 100 hours on public television, produced few shocks about what had happened that day. No single smoking gun. But the hearings were extraordinary and have already begun to change the political landscape of the nation's fifth largest city. The hearings put the inner workings of this city's government on public display in a way few city governments have ever been put on display. The picture they painted wasn't pretty. The hearings showed official bumbling, paralysis, arrogance, miscalculations, and communication breakdowns. They showed a city government failing at almost every step in its attempts to cope with MOVE, a small but difficult radical group. The people of Philadelphia have been able to look deeply into an incredible debacle, the Philadelphia Inquirer editorialized Friday. They have seen a police commissioner pleading ignorance so deep that if he is telling the truth, such ignorance alone should be grounds for dismissal. Seen a fire commissioner who agreed to let a fire grow out of control. Seen a managing director who may better have remained on vacation. They saw a mayor, too, who did not say no to dropping a bomb. A mayor who opted for the sidelines as police confronted MOVE and a neighborhood was consumed. Almost everything that could go wrong did. I, by the way, do not agree with that assessment. I think this was largely a result of design, or at least something that could have been anticipated by a person of common intelligence. Orders were disobeyed or ignored. Fire Commissioner William C. Richmond, for example, revealed that he never received an order from Good to put out the fire caused by the bomb, as if a fire chief needs to be told to put out a fire. I interject. The policeman who made the bomb used C4, a military explosive not authorized by Police Commissioner George Sambor. It was likely to trigger a fire and was unsuited for the job it was supposed to do, blow up a rooftop bunker and knock a hole in a roof, according to the testimony. When the same officer dropped the bomb from a helicopter, he almost missed the MOVE row house. When fire engulfed the house at a temperature above 2,000 degrees, a police videotape recorded officers laughing at the misfortune of MOVE members inside. This is the testimony that drove Mr. Ruth to a public display of frustration and anger. And yet nothing he did resulted in changes in policy or accountability on the part of the people in positions of responsibility in the Philadelphia city government, which is precisely why he was the right choice to be part, the most prominent part, of this three-member panel appointed by the ATF after the Waco disaster of 1993. The most significant change in federal policy over the last 30 years since the bombing of the MOVE is that they would no longer need to put an official in a helicopter to drop a satchel bomb on a building that has been targeted for annihilation. Now they can do this by remote control. A human drone sitting at a facility in Nevada can push a button controlling a mechanical drone halfway around the world that will fire a Hellfire missile and take out an entire block in Pakistan or Afghanistan or Somalia or Yemen. As I said, this has been a leitmotif in the policy of the regime that rules us. And I don't think that it's entirely coincidental that one of the implements of mass death used in this policy is called the Hellfire missile. Thank you for joining me on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I'll be back with you again in a week, and until then, as always, dum spirito pugno. While I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and maybe send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.